Matt wanted to know about tithing because he was concerned because he saw something on YouTube about tithing and people don't like it. And there's no, there are people marshal theological arguments against this. I'm very aware of this, and I don't want you to get the impression that because I gave it short shrift, I don't think it's a big deal. I didn't have class time to get into it. We could spend 2 hours talking about tithing and the whole doctrine behind it, because it is one of these flashpoint issues where all the antinomian arguments come rolling out. And that's what, and see, this is why you need to get straight on basic theological things, because it plays out all over the place. You know, if you have an antinomian presupposition, it's going to play out in your attitude towards tithing, because is tithing a law or a gospel thing?
Gospel.
Yeah, thanks Caleb for that.
Make a note.
I won't forget when it's April. I won't forget. All right, April certification meeting. So, anyway, you know, it's clearly of the law. And so, if you don't like the law, and if you're an anti-law guy, and you're and you think the gospel trumps everything, what room do you have left for tithing in your theology? It's gone. And that's the whole point. And so, you're right. You know, people make some really strong arguments, and then anybody who comes along suggesting, well, I think tithing is actually God's will, it's like, whoa, what are you, a legalist? And you know, pietist, you know, what's going on? And be ready for all the vitriol. You're going to get it. And my whole point is simply, and I was trying to get out, laying out in that stewardship article, is, hey, the law is okay. And the law does give us direction. And does it apply in this situation? It does. And so then tithing is just one piece of, if we're trying to figure out what God wants us to do with our money, I think tithing is a good place to start figuring it out. That's all I would say. And so am I suggesting that we're still underneath, you know, Mosaic law? No, I'm not saying that. I'm not suggesting that we somehow have to start keeping kosher and becoming Seventh-day Adventists. No, I'm not going there. But what I am saying is, clearly God has shown us His will regarding the use of our resources and our money, and clearly the tithe seems to be a pretty predominant idea throughout Scripture, not just OT. And if we're going to take seriously God's will, maybe we should pay attention to the tithe and actually come to terms with it a little bit. That's what I'm suggesting. And I think you can make a case for that. But obviously, it's going to be a case that has to be rightly placed in the whole law-gospel context, and you can't kind of do a law-gospel reductionistic move, or you're not going to have any room for it. That's exactly right. Is that adequate?
Yeah, I'm preaching a sermon on tithing this weekend, and so I was like, yeah, mind you, that's why I was on YouTube in the first place.
Yeah,
and
then I saw this sermon ideas, YouTube, you know.
Right.
This is crazy. There's just so many people who are like, in this name, don't do it because the Bible, you know, you can't point to anything.
Right.
So I dug into it.
I get that. Oh, good. I look forward to it then. All right. Yes, David.
Could we say that tithing is not part of the Mosaic law for us, but part of the natural law? So, like, you basically pay somebody what they deserve. You do that to keep the doors open?
Well, yeah, no, so that's how I would look at this. See, I look at this, while you have a 10% tithe, as kind of built into the fabric of things. It's what creatures should do. It's the right thing. And see, this is consistent how I look at the law altogether. I don't think any part of God's law is ever arbitrary and just kind of whipped out of thin air just to make life interesting. There are reasons for stuff, and it's always an expression of something. So if God said, here's what I want you to do, Israel, well, we should be asking the question, well, why? So what's that mean for us? What's going on here? And obviously, there's something about caring for others. And obviously, there's something about keeping God's in our right thinking and the perspective on this, that God is the giver, it's really His, and so 10%, whatever, yeah, go, take it. And that's why I think it's kind of, I would say it's more than just an arbitrary thing, and I think it's more than just a part of the Jewish, you know, cultural code. I think it is really closely akin to, this is the hardwired reality of how God put things together. We should pay attention to it. Yep. All right, adequate? Okay. Good, anything else? All right, so today you got three readings. Got the short one from Sacramone, a little chunk out of Krauth, and then this essay by Yeago. So, quick impressions. Did you like this stuff or not? All right.
I like the Krauth reading.
You like the Krauth reading. I'm glad. Okay. Sacramone is interesting. I've assigned this reading for several times now, and I like it. But people often don't. I'll get students who kind of start complaining about, he's just a whiner, he's just complaining, oh.
I saw a grumpy old Lutheran.
What's that?
Grumpy old
Lutheran. Yeah, see, I don't think he is a grumpy old Lutheran. He's not. And so I want to come to his defense a little bit. If you were thinking like, oh, he's just a whiner, he's just, you know, whatever. That's not what he's doing. So I want to try to defend Sacrament a little bit for what he's actually up to. And then we'll talk about Krauth, and we'll get into Diego as well, and we'll answer Adam's question. So in your, as you were reading these readings, and you know, they're all disparate, there they are, and I don't give you any clues to why I'm having you read stuff. It's just readings in the syllabus. What's tying them together? What's going on here?
Church and culture.
Church and culture is a big part of this, all right? No doubt. Okay, I agree. That's a big piece of this. What else is tying this all together? Yeah, Adam.
The church as a formative body that has substance.
All right, the church as a formative body. And indeed, this is the word I'm looking for today. It's this word of formation. That's what I think is going on in all three of these, in spades. And this is something we need to talk about because this is hardly ever talked about enough. You hear about pastoral formation all the time. We talk about it because we're forming you. But and we kind of just take it, oh yeah, I'm at the seminary, I get formed. Formation is just an essential aspect to just education, to being human, to being Christian. It's all about formation. And what's really tying these three essays together is really this in so many ways. Now, Krauth is hitting heavy on the theology, and man, those 9 or 10 pages, to me, are just so precise and so articulate and kind of holding everything together. And if you've been hearing me at all this quarter, you should be able to see how Krauth is kind of trying to tie all kinds of stuff together. Does doctrine matter? Yes. And is doctrine just arbitrarily Lutheran, or is it Christian? It's God's truth. And so when we try to express it rightly, we're trying to do it right. And are we being holier than thou? That's not the point. There's truth or there's not. And he makes some outstanding arguments along the way. The guy's brilliant. And as far as a tight logical argument, they don't get much better. And in 10 pages to make a case for why doctrine matters, you can't get much better than Krauth. I mean, just at least my opinion. It's just like, pow, there it is. Really strong. Now, so what about Sacramone? What's Sacramone doing that's got to do with formation? He's illustrating this clearly. Because what's his story? Okay? What's his story? He's editor at First Things. No small thing. All right? So that maybe that's why I'm sympathetic to him, because anybody who's editor at First Things has earned his credentials. All right? You guys familiar with First Things as a journal? It's when Newhouse started. The editor for a long time, and he turned it over to others. And so this is a top-notch journal in evangelical thinking, Lutheran thinking, neoconservative, Catholic, Lutheran kind of stuff. And it's a good journal. And so Sacramone's editing that. He's not a slouch. So what's his story? His story is he grows up in a Lutheran church. And does the description of his church growing up sound familiar? Yeah. Okay. And he loves matins. Why? It's shorter. Mercifully, he can get out sooner. And all he cares about is get out of there. He resists what's going on in the church. He's not interested. It's boring to him. He has no interest at all. All right. So that's a given. Then he goes off to college, starts wandering back into the church. And what doors does he take?
All of them.
Yeah. He's going through all kinds of different places. He talks about this big church he ends up in Manhattan. Who's he describing? Tim Keller's church. This is where he ends up. And then he ends up going back to another place, and he wants to go home to the church he used to have. But that church is not there anymore because that pastor has now become a priest. Who's he talking about? He's talking about Newhouse. Richard John Newhouse. He was part of Newhouse's church. All right. Now, does that ring any bells? Richard John Newhouse, Naked Public Square, American Babylon, Catholic Matters. Remember Religious Bodies? You read that? If you haven't had it, you haven't read it. So in Religious Bodies, you're going to read Catholic Matters. Newhouse is this guy. Newhouse graduated from here. He was a pastor in the LCMS. Then he became, well, actually, he became a pastor in the ELCA. Then he went to Rome and became a Catholic priest. Always outspoken. Very influential. Great, awesome writer. And he was the pastor for Sacramone. All right. So Sacramone then decides, what I need is what I grew up with. Where did he get that idea? It's this. When was Sacramone formed into the faith?
Matins.
When he was a kid. agonizing through Matins and page 15, going through the motions, hating it, chafing at it, he was being formed in spite of himself. You see, this is the reality. He can resist it, he can deride it all he wants. It's happening. He's being formed, and it's not insignificant. So that what happens then is this, when he realizes that he needs what only the church can give and he goes yearning for it, what does he yearn for? He yearns for the very thing he was formed in. So what Sacramone is giving you is a great living example of the power of this thing. And it's also a very entertaining article because he writes with such wit. And he talks about, you know, Starbucks in hand, a few choruses of he shall make me glad, grumbling through the, you know, the singing. Ah, sweet success, the new LCMS. Ouch! Man! And you see, what is he saying? He's saying, guys, pay attention to what you're doing, because the way you worship matters. That's what he's saying. And we're back to that old axiom, lex orandi, lex credendi, aren't we? And isn't that exactly what we're talking about here again? So, lex orandi, lex credendi. Have we hit that in here yet? I don't think we have. I think we have in here. In here? Yes. All right. So the law of praying is the law of believing. So what you do in your worship shapes what you believe profoundly. Why was it that he ended up being so unhappy in Keller's church? Here's this dude preacher, cool stuff going on, awesome community, yet something's not right. What's not right for him? Yes, the content's not right. The theology's messed up. It's not there. He knows it. The sacraments are limping. Something's not there. Why did he have such a crazy, where did this idea come from? See, this is more than just intellectual. It's not just because, yeah, he's been reading Paul. It's because he was formed into a way of understanding his faith and it made an impact on him. He was shaped into this life. That's what we're talking about. So formation is the whole idea of being shaped into a community. Shaped into a way of life. Shaped into a way of being. And see, the lex orandi, lex credendi is all part of that. You are formed by how you worship, by your practices, by the things you do. It shapes your theology, and it's profoundly important. You're formed into this, and this is where habituation comes into it as well. And so this starts to put a different spin on so many things, because habituation means you just drill it into your body. Muscle memory, that's become a common phrase now. What's that mean? It means you do a skill over and over and over and over again until your body just knows how to do it without even thinking or being told. Right? Is this not a core aspect of most athletic training? Of most musical instrument training? Why do people play arpeggios and scales till their fingers go numb? Because it's muscle memory. And what about military training? Why do you learn how to put a gun together blindfolded? You can even do it in a political ad. Why do you learn how to do this? Because you've got to be able to do it without even thinking. Second nature, just there. Because when the pressure's on or there's a crisis or something's going on, you don't want to think about this stuff. It's all about being habituated. Now, the weird thing is, everybody in the world gets this on anything that matters, military, sports, music. We all get how important this is. Then when it comes to the church, now we're content just to go with feelings. You see, habituation, that's boring. And making people memorize stuff, that's just head stuff. You see, we don't want empty head stuff. We want people to have a heartfelt experience of Jesus. And so it's far more important that we take our kids, our youth, on a retreat. And they all get their little prayer journal. And we send them off to sit underneath a white pine tree. And they reflect on nature and God. And they feel feelings. And then they write down what they feel. Because if they really feel Jesus, whoa, now it matters. Now it's important. And that's so, so much more meaningful than having them memorize rote parts of the catechism, much less Bible verses, or actually the other way around. I mean, Bible verses, yeah. But catechism, come on. What's the point of memorizing it? That's why they can read it. You've heard this stuff. You've made the argument, some of you. You should repent. Do you get what I'm saying here? Do you begin to see why you should repent? You see, and it doesn't have to be an either or. I'm all about having an understanding of what's going on, and it shouldn't just be head stuff. So Sacramone, yeah, he's a resistant kid. Far better to have a child who says, this is pretty cool. The pastor's actually kind of interesting. And we do some things that are a little different around here. And every once in a while, he spices things up and he throws in some kind of weird band arrangement. Who thought that coming? That's kind of cool. That's all awesome. It can all happen. But see, what's also happening is we're habituating people into this community. And it only comes through habituation. You just do it, you do it, you do it. Why do you think we have rote prayers? Why do you think we have things like the creed that we don't change? Why do you think Luther said, don't mess around with the form of it. Pick one, hang with it. Because you need to be habituated into it. That's the whole point. Now, I'm also a fan of throwing in the curveball every once in a while. And I think, on occasion, it's okay to have a winging out new creed translation. Just so everybody says, wait a minute, what am I saying here? And they actually pay attention once in a while. I'm fine with that too, but you don't do that every single Sunday or there's no continuity. You've got to have the continuity. You've got to have the habituation. But see, the very fact that you throw a curveball means you're throwing fastballs the rest of the time. That's why a curveball works. But if you throw a curveball every pitch, then it's not effective anymore. You get the idea here? The same thing goes with the habituation. We've got to be able to take seriously. There are things we just need to be doing and grinding this out. And this is a huge, huge argument for the liturgy. And following things that are familiar. It doesn't have to be boring. It doesn't have to be the same exact thing every week. Heaven forbid. And you can even play with the forms and structures. And it does not have to only come from LSB. I don't believe that. That's nonsense thought. The tradition we have in the church is so much wider than five services out of LSB. There's so much to do. But be careful, guys. Be careful. What are you habituating your people into? Because this is incontrovertible fact. It's just the way it is. You maybe don't like it. It's the way it is. It's how God has wired us as human beings. We get habituated and formed into things. That's what Sacramone is illustrating. And it's a beautiful, I think, illustration of the power of this. All right. Now, other thoughts on the Sacramone essay before we leave that and move on to other things. Go ahead, JP.
I just thought he was, obviously he's a writer. So he comes at it from a different perspective, but just brilliant to kind of take the approach. And then you think he's going to go somewhere. And then at the end, like, I think that's why people would be ticked off reading him is like, wait, what? Like, you just did all, you just, like, pledged your case and all this, and now you're saying, like, you want to go back to that misery? You know, I don't know. I thought it was good writing.
It's very good writing. He is a very good writer. I think it's a really well-written essay. I like that. I think it's a well-written essay.
Me to go, like, now, want to learn more about it.
But he is annoying because he says, hey, we're not them. Other people can be the hip church. Other people can be the cutting-edge doctrine church. Other people can be we're just the fellowship community. We are who we are, and we know that. We need to do what we do well. And I think there's actually some validity to this. And I think when we realize Christendom is very wide, you know, the whole Una Sancta thing, I've been stressing that. So it's all Christendom. And yet there are strains and traditions and schools within that big, wide thing. And we need to, I think what Sacramento is saying is, know who you are and quit trying to be everybody else. Because when you try to be everybody else, you start losing your very distinctives, and we should be unashamed of our distinctives and be able to celebrate them. And that's pretty much what Yago's up to as well. Know who you are, what makes you guys tick, and don't be ashamed of it. Celebrate these things. These are cool things. All right, anything else? Yeah, go ahead.
I think the reason people get more upset with Sacramento is not necessarily that he says, hey, we should be doing this. I think most people would agree this is pretty normal stuff. But when he takes it one step further and says, this should be mandated. This is this.
Yeah.
I think that's where people have more of like a hard time being like, I don't know about that. That sounds too Roman.
Yeah, but see, where is he coming from? I mean, he's a layperson, and he admits this as well. He's a layperson, and he's just saying, why is this not evident? Why are people not paying attention to this? And if people can't figure this out and just do it because they should, maybe we need to make some rules here, which is, I'm totally sympathetic with that. I get that. I see the temptation. I know, wait a minute, it's the church. We don't make rules. I get that too. But, I mean, we should be paying more attention to this, and that's what his plea is. Let's come clean. Let's pay attention to this. All right? Anything else in the Sacramone? Yeah. Go ahead, Andy.
I just think that this idea is really good when you think about some of the older members, especially if they suffer from dementia, Alzheimer's, that sort of thing, there are certain things that do stick despite diseases in the brain.
Definitely.
Which are just amazing. And I honestly feel sorry for people who don't get to speak the creed every week, who don't get to say the Lord's Prayer, who don't have hymns in their head that they've memorized, because you're not going to have much left if you get to that point.
This is exactly right. I agree with this completely. And see, there's something to this, just the imprinting that happens when you learn these things. And I think it's not just people older with dementia. It's even your college kids who, you know, when they're kind of falling away, what are some of the things they start thinking about? They remember the things that are there. And when they start thinking, wait a minute, I wonder about God, they're going to call back the things they have. It's going to be there or it's not going to be there. And it needs to be there for them because we need to have imprinted it into them. All right. Okay? Good? So what we're talking about today then is how significant this whole thing is and why this thing matters. So let's go to our essay from Yago. And let's take a look at this thing. So this was written in 2000, so 16 years old now already. Any thoughts about this one? What do you think of this particular essay? This one, isolated, just nothing else, just this one, not Krauss, not Sacramone. What do you think of Yago? Yeah, Adam.
I really liked it. He talks at one point about why do we assume that baptized people are actually living that Christian life, and you can do this adult confirmation, this catechesis with already baptized people. Like, you don't have to just for youth and then call it good.
Right. Okay. So he's talking a lot in here about catechesis. So when we talk about catechesis, what do we mean?
What do you mean?
Lifelong.
Yeah. It's formation in the faith. That's really what it is. And this word gets thrown around a lot, and people have, I think, a lot of visions of what they think it means. For a lot of people, it just means Burgundy Catechism, 7th and 8th grade, maybe 6th grade if we're really going to be demanding, you know, and that's it. But see, catechesis basically just means being formed into the faith. So when does catechesis start?
Baptism.
At birth. Immediately. And when does catechesis end?
Grave.
Yeah, when you're dead. But I'm of the opinion we'll probably keep on learning even at the Eschaton. But that's my hopeful attitude.
Because there's order.
There is order, and there's always more to know, because just because I'm resurrected doesn't mean I'm going to have God figured out. More to learn. How cool will that be? All right. So catechesis is the whole sense of lifelong learning, more than that. It's lifelong formation into the Christian faith. And now what we're really talking about is the whole idea of discipleship again. And now we start seeing how things like stewardship and discipleship and church discipline are all playing into this, aren't they? It's all talking about what does it mean to be part of this community? What does the life of this community look like? How does it present itself? What's it mean to become part of this thing? And that's what Yago is trying to get at. So Yago is trying to say, if we're going to take catechesis seriously, we need to recognize, first and foremost, it is always embodied. And we have a strong tendency still in our culture to disembody things, which is where you get the sense of the kind of Gnostic thinking. So a sort of neo-Gnosticism. So when I'm talking about neo-Gnosticism, what do I mean by that? You encountered this in other classes. Go ahead, Nicholas.
Yeah, if we have the tendency in our culture that body doesn't matter. For example, gender neutral and so on. So
it's what?
Gender neutral.
Yeah, okay.
That it's all about what you're thinking you are, mm-hmm. and not what your body
That's
is.
That's right. So we have this divorce that goes on between body and soul. And so we dichotomize the human and we split him into body and soul. And this is exceedingly Platonic. This is exactly what's going on here. This is just rank Platonism, and it's very Greek. So it's a Platonic thinking. And we split the human body into body and soul. And then, of course, we privilege the soul over the body, because the body is nothing more than a vehicle or a shell. And the real me is my soul. And away we go. And so we have a very disembodied thing. And so then what matters is the head, and the body is just insignificant. And Nicholas very wisely alighted this with the whole gender thing. Because if my body's not that important, who cares what my physical configuration is? I can be what I want to be. and then I'll create my body to match up with what I feel in my soul or my guts or my personality or my whatever it is. It's all the same thing. It's the me stuff. It's the real me inside. And this is nothing more than a shell and a body and a vehicle. And the reality, of course, is this is wrong thinking. This is not a scriptural way of thinking. In a scriptural way of thinking, we are humans, which are always body and soul wrapped together, overlapping, interpenetrating at every level. You can't pull them apart without killing it. It's the whole point. Death is ripping apart this thing that was never meant to be ripped apart. And that's why it's so wrong. And that's why it feels so wrong. And it's such a horrible thing. So this is a wrong way of thinking. Instead, we have a unity. And the point is, we are our bodies. And we are our minds. We don't, and this is Bonhoeffer who says this so beautifully, we don't have a body, we are a body. And so we are these things. So that means if we're going to take this thing seriously, catechesis needs to be paying attention to the whole person and the body and the physical health as well. It's not just head stuff. So habituation is so much more than just learning some facts. It's about being trained into living a certain way. Learning how to handle our bodies and our emotions and our money and our families. All of it matters. That's where we're going with this thing. All right. Good? So let's take a look at some highlights in Yeago and walk our way through this essay then. So he's talking about first, his very first section is the disembodiment of Christianity. And he's talking about how this Gnosticism, and Gnosticism is just taking Platonic thought and trying to warm it over with a little Christianity shot into it. That's what it is. And the key thing with Gnosticism is not the cool secret knowledge. The real key thing with Gnosticism is body's bad, material evil. That's the driving thing. So when you have people who are dismissing the bodily as not important, you got Gnosticism going. It shows up all over the place, guys. It shows up in the people who come out of church and say, you know, Pastor, you know, our worship is nice and communion's nice, but I just don't feel much. And I went to this church this past weekend, and man, whoa, what a service they had. And I really felt God there. And it was awesome. Can't we get something like that? That's Gnostic. Because you see, what they're saying is the mere outward forms like bread and wine, body and blood, those are tangible, real things. It doesn't work for me. I'm looking for a God connection. I'm looking for a Jesus feeling. And I got that over here. That's a lot better than this just empty ritual. And what has happened is they're functioning with a disembodied Christianity. Because the mere forms, the outward stuff, that doesn't matter. What matters is the real deal. And this traces back to lecture on day two in here. The whole idea of, you know, the outward forms of the church doesn't matter. What matters is the interior you and your Jesus stuff. It's the same kind of idea going here. And this minimizing the importance of the bodily. All right, good? So then Yeago makes the argument that how does this engage the world? Well, you see, a neo-Gnostic disembodied Christianity is very palatable in our culture because it's something that just goes on in your head and it's something very private and very personal and it doesn't make any real difference to anybody. And that's tolerated. We can put up with that. But what's not acceptable is when you actually have ways of living that make you look kind of weird or that demand that you do certain things or that actually start to impose something on some other people. That's a problem. And that gets a little too weird. And that's not acceptable. And that's really what he's getting at here. So on page 6, second column, first full paragraph, halfway down. It is quite different, however, when religious people make claims that involve God's immediate presence in some concrete shaping or ordering of the public world. And by public, he's not just talking about government. He's just talking about the lives we live out there. Then a whole vocabulary of denigration is brought immediately to bear, and a whole strategy of repression comes into play. So if Christians come along and say, I think a baby in the womb is a real life, and we shouldn't kill it. Oh, you're forcing your morality on me. That's your private opinion. I'm not telling you you have to have an abortion, so leave your opinion to yourself, and you know how it all goes. And see, the very problem is they're trying to take a concrete reality and apply it in a public forum, and that's simply deemed unacceptable. So that's kind of what's going on here. Oh, by the way, Yeago, what do you know about this dude Yeago before we go any further? Anybody do any checking?
Yeah, he used to be ELCA, I guess, and left them and was one of their seminary instructors. Now he's at the new NA, he's basically NALC.
Yes. So he was an ELCA theologian and prof for a long time, always not a very happy one, and no one liked him.
Yeah, he's not kind of grumpy. I read one of his speeches to a you know, it was right after the 2010 decision, and it was pretty pointed. I was like, wow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He definitely raised some had some enemies in the ELCA because he was not party line. He was far too conservative for them. And so now he's part of the NALC, that's correct. And so, yeah, this is where he was coming from. So he's not an LCMS guy. But, I mean, his take on things is, I think, very accurate. And I have always benefited from his work. I think he's got a lot to offer us. All right, so we go to page 7. And we hit the first column, bottom of the page. Last paragraph. The apostolic proclamation of salvation is thus relentlessly corporeal and public. What the New Testament means by salvation is inseparable from bodily adherence to a visible community. And that's critical. What the New Testament means by salvation is inseparable from bodily adherence to a visible community. See, already we are light years away from most of evangelicalism. Because how does an evangelical work? You get your four spiritual laws handed to you at the orientation you go to, and then you go home and read it in your dorm, and you say, oh, I want Jesus to be my Savior. So then you go into the closet, get down on your knees, and you pray the sinner's prayer, and you're in. You're in. And then if you want to make somebody at Four Spiritual Laws Publishing happy, you sign it and send it in, and they can pray for you. There, I'm in. And look, here's my card. I've carried my wallet. When did I become a Christian? Here it is. I got my Get Into Heaven card. I'm cool. And you see, and we have people who celebrate, yes, you see, the gospel worked again. Awesome. Has this guy actually been brought into the community of God? No. It's just a sham. It's missing the whole point. Because to be saved, salvation is to be part of a visible community. It's to be living into this life. So it's all of this stuff going on here. That's what Yago's saying. Remember, this is a Lutheran saying this stuff. All right, so he goes on. One is initiated into this community by corporeal washing, and the center of its life is a Thanksgiving meal with bread and wine. Within the community constituted by these practices, the faithful are exhorted not to become virtuosos of the inner life, but to present their bodies to the Lord as instruments of His righteousness. See, it's not about pulling in on yourself and figuring out your feelings and having experiences and the mystical connections with God. It's really just about grinding out your life according to God's will, being part of this community of faith. And a lot of it is mundane and boring, and it's not really feeling oriented. It's just grinding it out. And that's what it means to be living the life. And that's where stuff's going on. So there's a lot more going on at a potluck meal or at a Thanksgiving, you know, thing that we're going to take meals to underprivileged people and, you know, just figuring out how to get it done and drive everybody out there. And it doesn't have to all be emotional. You don't get great video shots to post on YouTube of, you know, everybody, oh, it's all weepy. Maybe you don't get any of that stuff. It's just people, yeah, thanks, appreciate it. This is what happened. This is the church being the church. And we shouldn't ever downplay how important those things are. That's what he's getting at here. All right. Okay. Good. So we go on. So then he talks about how important this whole idea of family prayer was back in the old days. And he talks about Stark's prayer journal. And Stark was one of these kinds of pietist guys. And Yago's funny because what's Yago's take on pietism? Not so bad. And Krauth surprises you too. What's Krauth's take on pietism? Not so bad, because they're actually paying attention to stuff. It's when you start letting go of your roots that you get into trouble. And the idea of actually saying, maybe we should live this life, maybe it should be apparent in how we act. What's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that. And yet we flee from that all the time because that sounds like legalism, that sounds like pietism, and that's exactly back to the tithing thing. See, because tithing means, you mean I got to think about how I spend my money? Mm-hmm. And I can't just do whatever I want with it? No. And God really does expect me to take 10% off the top and give it to Him? Yeah. It's pretty demanding. Yes, it is. Yep. Well, isn't there a way around this? Not if you want to live in the community of faith. What's the problem here? And see, that's the reality. There are implications that come from this. All right. Now, so he talks with them about family prayer. I think he's quite right about this. And then he gets into how this whole thing plays out. So the method of the essay shows up on page 9. This is right before the page break. First column halfway down. Lutherans, that is to say, have been particularly hard hit theologically by the modern disembodiment of Christianity. Indeed, one useful way to describe Lutheran history in the modern world is to look at the different ways Lutherans have reacted to modernity's way of drawing the line between the public and the private and its relegation of religion to the private sphere. Three broad patterns of response can be identified. Now, what Yago's doing is he's saying, in the context of our Western world. This is the Enlightenment story, and you've heard me tell that story in other classes. You've probably heard it in other classes. You should know it by now. It shows up in history courses and systematics courses. So Descartes kicks us off on the Enlightenment trajectory, right? Religious bodies. Okay. How many of you have not had religious bodies yet? Oh, you've got to be kidding.
Talk to the curriculum people.
Maybe they'll get it fixed.
See you in the winter here.
They told All right, fine. I'll just be patient and we'll hold off until next quarter. Wow. That's why they're giving me these blank looks like, oh, what are you talking about, Descartes? Enlightenment story, whatever. Adam, am I right? All right, thank you. Mike, am I right? You've been there, all right. Okay, we'll do it next quarter. Yay. All right, so what he's saying is, take my word for this, we live in a culture that has progressed to the point, and there are reasons for this, and we'll get into the reasons next quarter, but we have got to the point where now we have this marked divide between the public and the private. And privatized interior stuff is acceptable, but don't you drag it into public on me. And so then the church is left figuring out, so what do we do with this? So he says there's three ways of kind of handling this. So the first way he describes is what he calls the doctrinal answer to this. So he's talking about doctrinal existential Lutheranism. So the first one is this, still page 9, first column. The simplest way to adapt Lutheranism to modern culture is to identify the substance of Lutheranism with a doctrine, a theological teaching, and to separate doctrine from practice so that the doctrine can live a disembodied existence in the mind. Notion of adiaphoron can then be summoned to establish the required distance between the inward essence of religion and its secondary outward expression. Nah, it doesn't matter. That's just adiaphora. All Lutheranism has made this move to some degree, though it has perhaps been the specialty of self-consciously conservative Lutherans. Read LCMS. It is possible in this way to talk a vociferously anti-modern line while in reality playing obediently by modernity's rules. LCMS. In ways far more than we realize. So we are so opposed to modernity. No, none of that stuff. But then we turn right around and we just reduce religion to a head thing. As if it's just knowing a bunch of facts. Get these facts straight. If you agree with this stuff and you understand it, you can get 98% of the test, or 70 is good enough. And if you can pass the test, you're a Lutheran. In. Done. There. Catechized. This kid's done. Next. Isn't that how we operate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even our adult catechesis, how do we typically do it? Guy shows up, okay, I'm marrying this woman. Her parents said I got to become a Lutheran. Okay, what do I got to do?
8 hours, let's run through it.
Let's do it. 8 hours of instruction. We're really grueling around here. And you're going to read this book with me. We're going to talk about it. And you're going to understand these things. And the guy's, okay. So he teach him. He understands all these things. He signs in the line. In. Just like that. Get your flying cross card. You're in, dude. How cool is that?
And a blaze pin.
Yeah, and you can get a blaze pin too, yeah. If you're really serious. You know, you have to do a certain level to get that. All right. So this he's describing us. Now, how is that still modern? What's modern about this?
Only head.
No. It's only the head. The body's just left out. Because see, the bodies don't matter anyway. Bodies don't count. Don't worry about all that stuff. Don't worry about memorizing stuff. Don't worry about knowing what Lent means. Don't worry about all that body stuff. Don't worry about prayer life. Don't worry about, you know, your personal piety. Don't worry about tithing. You know, don't worry about all that stuff. That just comes later. That's not essential. Not really essential. And in fact, it is part of the whole life. Indeed, I would make the argument, you really can't claim to be a Lutheran until you've lived through the entire church here at least once or twice. At least once or twice. Because you've got to just know what Lent's about. And live through a few Advent seasons and live through all the pericopes and hear the preaching and be formed by the worship. It takes a while to get habituated. It doesn't happen by the head getting educated by a few basic truths. So that's what he's getting at here. So the first thing he's nailing is us. And then, top of page 9, and this just really is an ouch. Thus, even many of our most serious pastors tend to assume that what people need when they join the church is an introduction to Lutheran doctrine. No special initiation of the way Lutherans live or pray or sing is required. Being Lutheran is identified simply with holding certain views. And we are surprised when we are told that all the ways in which we live and pray and sing are, after all, only style. Can be easily distinguished from the doctrinal substance, which for its part can be packaged in any style our customers prefer. And there was a book that guy Lukey published through CPH a few years ago, and it made a huge inroads. Lutheran Substance, Evangelical Style, or something like that. And so he's making the strong division, which goes on all the time, between doctrine and practice. And this is still so widespread. People assume that, okay, my doctrine's what I learned at the seminary. Cool, that hasn't changed a bit. Now my practice is going to be a little different. I'm going to do some different things, and that's not going to matter because my doctrine is still fine. That's a complete violation of the rule. To think you can pull doctrine and practice apart and keep your doctrine solid while you're monkeying around with all kinds of strange practices, you are disregarding this fundamental rule. It's not going to happen. What you do is going to impact what you believe. Cannot be helped. It's just the way it is, people. So when you worship like an evangelical, you start thinking like one. When you worship like a Pentecostal, you start believing like one. And when you worship like a Greek Orthodox, you start believing like one. Is there evidence of this? Ample. Ample. So I'm not just picking on one side or the other on this thing, guys, okay? Hear me on this. It's not just he's anti-contemporary. No, I'm not. I'm anti taking seriously formation and acting like it doesn't matter that much. It matters enormously, enormously. All right, so then the second way to deal with it, though, and the other option, is to go with the existential route. And so this is the next one he gets into. More powerful in the ELCA has been what I would call the existentialist approach, with ultimate roots in the Ritschlian theology of the 19th century, but coming to us directly from the so-called Luther Renaissance of the early 20th. This stream of Lutheran thinking has adapted to modernity's pressure by reconfiguring the dialectical oppositions characteristic of Reformation theology, certainly, centrally, the distinction of law and gospel around the modern distinction between the secular public world and the inwardness of religion. So in other words, we now have to have just this experience of God, which happens apart from any particular doctrinal formulations. The doctrinal formulations aren't that important, and even the historical grounding is not that important. What matters more is the encounter you have of God right here, right now. Now, we have to be careful. I want you to sort this out, so you got to think hard on this one. Who is it that exemplifies this? Give me a name. This is exactly what Gerhard Ferdy talks about. Now, what's hard is because in Lutheran mind, you're told, hey, Ferdy's cool, this is really helpful, proclamation, not explanation. But see, one of the real liabilities of Ferdy, and maybe you got into this in Lutheran mind, maybe you didn't, but one of the real liabilities is, how much does history matter for Ferdy? Not very much. What matters, what's that?
Ask him about creation.
In fact, for Ferdy, he even talks about the bad news of the past tense. All that matters is present tense right here, right now. Jesus is here for you now. And he's right about this. Christ presently proclaimed is the key. But if there's not some historical grounding, what do we have? We're left with just the experience of the Jesus thing. And then we're only half a step away from a Bultmann demystifying the text. So the story of Jesus isn't nearly as important as the encounter of Jesus. And whether or not Jesus rose from the dead isn't nearly as important as the idea that he can and that you can too. And what matters is that you have the experience of meeting Jesus, and he clobbers you with his present reality, very Barthian, that there he is for you. And the historical stuff, that's a problem of history. Let's not get bogged down with that. And that's exactly what the existentialist approach gives you. And does that sound like the ELCA kind of thinking? Well, it should. And this is what they've embodied. But see, we are not so many far steps away from this. When we start to act like all that matters is the present tense reality, we've got to be able to find a way to say the history also matters. Because you see, history is part of this embodiment. Embodiment means it actually happened. It's grounded in time and place. History is part of the embodiment. Real people, the corporeal reality. Jesus is a real guy. Really died, really rose, under Pilate. Stuff matters. It's not insignificant. Okay, tracking with me on this? Yeah, James.
Is this kind of what I started reading the Hauerwas book a little bit? Is that
oh, good.
What he's talking about? Trying to, don't conform the gospel to the world. You live in the world, and, the gospel doesn't move. Society needs to move to conform. Is that kind of what he's talking about here in the second part?
Yeah, we'll spend some time
yeah,
with that.
Yes.
Hauerwas is very sympathetic to the arguments Diego's making. Yes. Hauerwas and Willimon are making the same kinds of arguments.
Okay.
And I kind of like them. Okay. All right. Good? So we go on then. So then he picks up, so what's his solution going to be? If a doctrinal answer is not going to be helpful and a purely existential answer is not helpful, what's he going to propose? What's his answer? He calls it sacramental Lutheranism. Now, and what's he mean by a sacramental Lutheranism? Does he just mean celebrate communion a lot?
Every day.
So, well, he probably wouldn't mind that. But what's he mean by sacramental Lutheranism? Yeah, Adam.
A Lutheranism that's grounded in the physical and the spiritual together and united in one, in all things.
Right, which is precisely the definition of a sacrament, right? Sacrament takes spiritual, profound realities, binds them to concrete, profound, tangible realities, and says, here's God's truth, here's God's gift. So, can you have communion apart from bread and wine? Of course not. Can you have a baptism apart from water? Of course not. And is the water insignificant? No, it's very significant. And it's not just, well, it's just kind of the conduit. No, it's the binding together of this thing. See, it's the same idea with Jesus. Does Jesus' physical, corporeal reality matter? Yes. It does. You know, how important is this? That's why docetism is such a big problem. Docetism says, who cares if he has a real body? All that matters is the truth at work here. No, it matters. He's incarnate or he's not. He's joined us or not. And if he has joined us, that changes everything. Everything's different now, because now bodies matter. And that's why Gnostics are just totally thrown out, because Christ is incarnate. You can't get past that. And so the sacraments make the same move. It's incarnating God's reality. It's incarnating God's truth and making it tangible and physical and measurable and real for us right here, right now. That's what he's getting at. All right. Cool? Good? So we move on. So that's where he's going to go then. His sacramental Lutheranism is what he wants. So on the page 11, he starts to actually apply this. And this is where things get actually quite interesting in this essay. So we're in the second column, right underneath the new page break. One of the most significant and disturbing developments in the church history of the second half of the 20th century has been the declining ability of so-called mainline churches in the Northern Hemisphere to make much difference to their members. This is not to deny that these churches continue in many cases to play an important role in the lives of their members. It is to recognize that those lives nevertheless look very much the same as they would without the church. Is that true or not? What's your reaction to that? To me, this is like, ouch.
Yeah, I mean, dude. People show up to church and then they got their little church life and then walk out the door.
What did I do on Sunday?
That's right. And if the church would fold, they would just say, I guess now I've got some time on Sunday mornings. Does their life substantially change from Monday through Saturday because of their relationship to Christ? And for most people, it doesn't. This is profoundly accurate. And it's unsettlingly accurate. It should bother you how true this is. And I think he's exactly right. So we don't make any real difference in the lives of our members. And I think he's exactly right. Dave.
Again, I came across it in something I was reading recently, the concept that you would move to be involved in a church.
Right.
So like if your job moves, you'll move at the drop of a hat. If your family moves, you move at the drop of a hat. But if like you don't have access to a good, solid church, the idea that you would move to be near one,
right,
is just like the farthest from our thinking.
Right.
I mean, it even sounds weird to me.
Yeah. So this is the whole idea of, I'm going to move here, now I've got to try to find a church that's going to work. Instead of saying, I should go where the church is going to be for me. And if I can't, if there's not a church there that's going to work for me, I won't take this job. You get this, you know, see, even less dramatic than moving, what about colleges? You get this all the time with kids going away to college. Well, there's no Lutheran church, you know, there's no Lutheran campus. Well, then why are you going there? Well, that's where I got to. And exactly right. See, the concept is somehow God and church will fit into my life when convenient. But the idea of actually building my life around it, that's weird. And you're exactly right. Even for us to say it, it seems like that's kind of weird, but it's exactly right. So his next sentence, right on point. Very precisely, the church tends more and more to play a role in lives otherwise structured and constituted. It is not very often what structures and constitutes those lives. See, it's the thing I've been saying about the direction of fit. Are we fitting ourselves into the church, or are we just trying to fit the church into our lives where convenient? And then how do we operate when we're dealing with people in the church? Are we trying to make it easy for them? Oh, you've got soccer camp. Oh, you've got a hockey thing that weekend. Okay, then we'll reschedule confirmation this year. instead of just saying, this is the way it is, I guess you have to quit your hockey camp. You would think you're just told something that you're sentencing them to death.
You couldn't do that in Michigan.
Well, you see, you can't select soccer, volleyball, take your pick. It's like, those are sacred, inviolate. You can't dream of touching that. And so, Pastor, you got to figure out how to build your schedule around our life. Where did this come from? Why aren't we telling people what is the most important thing in your life? What counts? Why aren't you building your life around this reality and figuring out how you're going to build your week around your responsibilities at church and your functioning at church? Isn't that the way it should be? You all know the answer. And don't act like you're afraid to do it because you know it's what's right. And this is where Howell Ross and William are going to drive you here as you start reading them, because they're playing the same game. If we're going to take our faith seriously, then let's take it seriously. And why are we giving people junk and acting like that's Christianity? So many of the problems we have in the church are because we've created them over trying to figure out how to meet people's needs and how to try to make the church relevant. It is relevant. It's inherently relevant. We don't need to sell it. We just need to have the confidence to speak it and have the guts to declare it instead of apologizing for it all the time.
It's a problem maybe also that we are not anymore act like a congregation in the way that we search our friends in our congregation and we do something with the members of the congregation. And today we have completely split between they are going to church and they are my friends.
No, I agree. Yeah, we have our lives all bifurcated out, and we do it between work and church, friends and church, entertainment and church. And so I got my spiritual life, and boy, Pastor, look, I'm really committed. I'm here every Sunday. This is really important to me, and this is a big deal. But then I've got my life over here, and these two do not connect. And you shouldn't expect them to. Be happy you've got your hour or two on Sunday morning, man. I mean, that's the attitude. The notion that somehow what I tell you here should fill into all of your life and you should be building your life around these truths, it's mind-blowing for most people.
I think part of the challenge with this, why we don't have churches that are confident claiming it or doing it, is by and large, there's not a lot of pastors who whose family is oriented around the church.
Correct. Either
I still want my kid to play in select soccer.
Correct.
And I still want my kid to get into the right college, and I
Correct.
Still want him to have the right job. Mm-hmm. And as long as he also has faith, it's okay.
Well, you've put your finger on it, Adam. You can't expect your people to do what you're not doing. And if a pastor is content to have just church as part of his life and gets his paycheck from it, that's all his people are ever going to do. No one's going to do more than the pastor does. And so, yeah, you guys have to decide, what do I believe about this stuff? Do I really believe that God should so form me and my life should be so built that this is the primary, most important thing, and that I would rather have my child strong in the faith than going to the best college? Seriously? Are you ready to buy into this? I think you should be, obviously. Well, there's nothing to debate in my mind on this, but you guys have got to figure it out. And if you haven't come to terms with this, you know, yeah, that's the first step, clearly.
Now, the flip side of that I wonder, I have several friends who grew up as pastor's kids, and their dads were so invested in the church and the life of the church that there's very little investment in them. And
all right, let me speak to this really quickly. So I'm a PK too, okay? So many of you in the room are. I get this. I see one of two things happening. Some kids grow up in a PK home and they resent the heck out of it and they want nothing to do with it. And I would say that indicates, and don't take this personally, do take it personally. This indicates an absolute failure of that pastor, because it means that he chose the church over his family, and that was wrong. It's wrong. Hear me. It's wrong. You have a vocational responsibility to your wife and your kids. You cannot shirk that in the name of going off and serving the church. That's wrong. And the men who grow up in a home with the father as a pastor and say, I want to be like him, that pastor's doing it right. Because he is living his life focused on what God put him there to do. He's loving his kids. He's got the balance, and they're seeing it. They're not resenting it. And you need to make sure you're emulating that. So you don't serve God well by going off and, I'm doing noble church work, and my little wife and children. You have to understand, I have to serve God with my life. And what I would say to that guy is, yeah, you serve God by doing what God put you there to do. Go home and love your wife and kids. And go fly a kite with your kids this afternoon instead of visiting or blogging some more.
Thanks, Dr. Moore.
Yeah. Now, Sacramento's getting paid to do that. All right, that's his vocation.
And he's a writer.
And, no, exactly, he's a writer. He's an editor. That's what he does for his 40 hours a week or 60
So you can blog once you become a writer.
Yeah, so if you like to blog and get paid for it. All right, top of 12. First column. The problem is not one that can be solved by mere exhortation or even by a time and talent stewardship emphasis. Its roots lie deep in the way modern mainline Christianity presents itself to its adherents, in the way our churches conceive of themselves and their mission. The modern disembodiment of Christianity has as its consequence that we have largely ceased to think of Christianity as giving its own shape to human existence. It is presented rather as an enhancement, a consolation, perhaps a source of power within a life whose shape is fundamentally determined by the autonomous forces of the secular public world and by the fears and cravings those forces stir within us. See, we are identified by the world around us, and then the church just enhances or complements or sustains that, but it doesn't norm and direct me. We are so far short of what God would expect us to be, and Yeagle just nails this thing. Just absolutely nails it. All right, bottom of the page, key thought. This is where the get the whole law gospel reductionism comes into this, and he's right about this, and that's a whole side part of this discussion. He hopefully have covered that thoroughly in Systems 3, that the whole antinomian stuff has to be shot down, because if you're going to play the law gospel reductionist thing, then as soon as you start talking about habituation, that gets thrown out too. Because formation habituation is primarily about doing stuff again and again and again. Is that law or gospel? Yes, of course it is. And if I'm a law gospel reductionist antinomian, what am I going to think about this? Who needs it? Doesn't matter. That doesn't sound like the gospel to me. Done. Throw it out too, along with tithing, along with church discipline. You see how many of those things tie into that fundamental thing. Read my book. All right. Bottom of 12. I can't assign it all. All right. Bottom of 12. Key thought then. This is the last eight lines or so. That is, the problem of the law is that it identifies what is expected of us, but does not give us the power to attain it. Or else it might be that the problem is simply the very fact that God expects something of us. Then salvation would mean that God decides to expect nothing of us, and as God ceases to look towards any purpose or goal for our existence. So this is how the gospel gets construed all the time. You used to have to live in the law. Not anymore. God expects nothing of you. Oh, cool. Good. I'll just go to church when I feel like it, do what I want the rest of my life. Cool. I don't have to tithe. I don't have to do anything. It's cool. And we have people who actually believe that's what the gospel is. Christian freedom. That's a huge theological problem.
What's that? I was just going to say, when you read Sacramone, like, he kind of toes the line there, going there as well. Like, yeah, it's just law gospel. Like,
it's more than that. Right. Yeah, he's oversimplifying things. He's not a theologian. We can give him a pass. All right. At least I will. All right. Okay, so then the gospel and the law gets all messed up. So then we have the very bottom of page 13. I'm in the first column, last four lines. So what we have then is, or last eight lines or so, the church likewise will not be the point at which our bodily existence is assumed into the crucified body of Jesus and receives the form of that body through continual death and resurrection in a Christ-configured mode of life together. Instead, it will be the smoothly integrated into the consumer society, a service provider, offering individuals the luxury goods of a disembodied inner peace and techniques for stress management. That's what the church is today. Give you a little encouragement for the week, help you sort out your life, give you a few pointers, make you feel good about things, and send you on your way. We're here to help you be more productive in your life.
Joel Osteen.
Precisely. Is the church really content with that? And unfortunately, too much of it is. I am pleading with you guys not to be content with that, and don't fall into that trap. All right, so then on page 14, he slams Confercamp. Love that. Just love it. What he calls the catastrophic decay of catechesis. And so I'm right in the middle of the page. He writes, if the whole gospel is reduced to God accepts you just as you are, you don't have to do anything. Well, one can see why the old three-year catechesis of the young has been supplanted by Confercamp. Right. So this is go off on a weekend retreat, feel some Jesus moments, write some things down in our journal, stand up in front of church and share with everybody how Jesus is so meaningful to me, and we all feel good. And we confirm the kids and send them on their way. Off into perdition, most likely. All right. Well, they go to college then, and then they wander away from their faith, and didn't mean much to me anyway, and I have learned new things, because they're not rooted in anything. They're not grounded in anything. Why are we surprised people wander away from the faith when we haven't habituated and informed them? Why are we surprised? You hear this all the time. I'm really concerned about people falling away from the faith. Right. What are you doing to prepare this? That's where the issue is. All right. Good. So now I'm still on page 14, second column. about a dozen lines down. It is one thing to demand doing something as a prerequisite, a qualifying worthiness for receiving a gift. It's quite another if the gift itself involves the recipient in a new life. And doing something is not a prior condition to be met, but the very gift that is to be received. The free gift of God in Christ Jesus, we need to say, is that we get to do all sorts of splendid things as His priestly people. So to be part of this Christian community comes with a way of life. And that way of life is demanding. And yet, that way of life is, in a sense, the gift itself. It's not the gospel, because the gospel is this just carte blanche, free forgiveness of Christ. But now, with that gift comes, you are now embodied in Christ, and there's a way that you live with this. And it's not enslaving. It's the only thing that's truly liberating. All right, good. Then he talks about catechetical preaching. He wants it to happen, encourages this, talks about how important it is that we do frequent celebration of the Lord's Supper. He's a high liturgy guy. You need to know that about Jacob too. You probably could guess it. He's a high church kind of guy, all over liturgical renewal. Then the last part of this, though, is so good. It's worth reading out carefully. Page 16. And I'm just three lines down from the top of the page, right-hand column, where he's wrapping up this whole article. And this is so well said. If we do not teach the catechism, if our people do not learn to participate in the liturgy, if our children do not know the Bible stories and cannot sing along in worship, if we do not begin to recover practices of formation, ways of prayer and meditation and fasting and celebration that bind daily life with the worshiping assembly in a priestly mode of common life, then our churches will simply fade into spiritual inconsequence over the coming decades, however many new members we have, and whatever the outcome of our ecclesiastical politics. So the church is not going to just go away. It'll still be around, a very important service provider for people's felt spiritual needs. But will it be the church? Will it be the body of Christ? And he's saying it won't be. It's going to be a mere shell. And this plays in perfectly also with stuff you'll do in religious bodies next quarter, MTD. But we'll get to that next quarter. I can live with it. We'll deal with it. All right. Is he being melodramatic, or do you think he's right? I think he's right, guys. And we need to take this very seriously. And so this is why. And there's room for liturgical variety, guys. There's room for this. There's room for a guitar in worship. There's room for new songs. There's room for new experimental things. There's room for all of this. But your people need to participate. They need to act like it matters. And what you cannot ever conscience is people who see worship as entertainment, who just sit there and watch what's going on and decide whether they like it or not, or just listen to the music. No, it's participatory. You sing. Marva Dawn gets this so well. I commend her works to you on worship, A Royal Waste of Time and I'm Reaching Out Without Dumbing Down. Two good texts. And if you have not read Marva Dawn, you should. She says this really well. What's that?
I'm sorry, did you spell it?
Dawn, just D-A-W-N, Marva Dawn. And book I would recommend is A Royal Waste of Time. She says in there, among so many things that are very good, she says probably the single best indicator of whether or not a child will remain in the faith is simply to ask whether or not that child's father sings the liturgy. And if the child sings, his child's father sings the liturgy, the child is very likely to stay in the faith. And if the father does not sing, probably not. And she says she's not proven this, but I think she's right on the money. Right on the money. Because a dad who comes to church and sits there, even though he takes the kids to church every Sunday, but he sits there and won't sing, what's the message he's telling his kids? Doesn't matter. It's not real. I'm not that good a singer. I'm a little embarrassed to do this. So I won't invest the risk of looking dumb by singing, so it doesn't matter that much to me. So the child learns it's not that real. Doesn't matter. So I shared this with a group of men one time, and heard the word back later on. One of the people who had participated said, hey, you should hear Charlie. He's got a terrible voice, but he's singing at the top of his lungs now. And he's got two little boys who are watching. And I thought, awesome. Awesome. Yeah, yay, Charlie. Exactly right. This is exactly right. All right, anything else on Yago? Yeah.
So back to that question I asked earlier, where would you go to begin this?
All right, so where do you begin? You begin by simply being committed to the church here. And the pericopes, and doing the readings, and making sure people are hearing the readings. You begin by being committed to using liturgy and taking seriously the worship formation. Don't just, crank through LSB the same every week as everybody knows it. Work at it. Teach them new hymns. Teach them new parts of liturgy. Stand up during the liturgy and say, now we're going to sing the Kyrie. Here's why. Here's what this means. Here's what's going on here. And you educate them into the depth of what's happening. And you do this on an ongoing basis. You get really serious about your catechesis for your young people, and you choose materials. But then you also think about how we're going to incorporate worship into our catechesis. So maybe we need to start every Wednesday evening catechism time or Saturday morning catechism time with 15 minutes of worship. And your worship isn't just singing hymns and reading a Bible verse, but you actually go through like morning prayer or something. And you help them, you form them. You teach them how to make the sign of the cross. You kneel if you've got kneelers. If you don't kneel, have kneelers, have them kneel on the floor for crying out loud. You get them used to the way things feel, and you're using your body. So you start getting serious about this whole life stuff. And then you start getting serious about scheduling potlucks. Seriously. Potlucks, because potlucks get people together, sharing food, sharing time, learning how to share life together. And you have a devotion when the potluck starts, or a time of, you know, prayer together. And you model this kind of stuff. You make materials available for your people, like Little Visits with God, Portals of Prayer, My Devotions. You teach your people how to use them. You model it by doing them, and you make the stuff available. This is what it's about. And it's just grinding it out all the time. That's what it does it. That help? All right. Andy.
Assuming that Diego's correct, and I'm inclined to say that he is, we almost kind of have to assume that we're starting from scratch in terms of the formation process, maybe with adults. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Don't presume on a huge, great, you know, legacy of lots of stuff there, because in the late 20th century and into the early part of this century, we've been so sloppy and so lax on this stuff that we have gotten really careless. And see, this gets even into like worship. And he talks in there about, he talks about this in other places as well. He's written several essays that I found very helpful, that a lot of people are kind of going for a stripped down kind of liturgy, Protestant light. You know, we don't want to get too heavy, you know, at Sanctus and Kyries and all. Yeah, it gets a little, you know, introits, you know, let's just kind of strip it out. What do we need? And then you get the five things you have to have in every service. You have to have a scripture, you have to have a confession, you have to have the Lord's Prayer, you have to have a creed, and you should have a benediction, probably a sermon. And you have to have those things. And if you have those things, check, 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 good, we're good, done. And now the problem is, if you have that week after week after week after week, and all you have is a stripped down service, what kind of depth are you going to get? What are you going to learn? Nothing. And so it matters. And so don't assume that people are formed. They're probably not. So start working at it. But you can't do it all at once. It's this whole point of habituation. This is not a three-week emphasis. This is not a special Lenten emphasis. We're going to get everybody formed. You're talking a lifetime. And you just got to be faithful in doing it. But see, this is why it's so important. Because if you're not faithful and you drop the ball, how many people are being damned and condemned to a lousy kind of form of Christianity? It's that whole generation, and all of them will come behind. You are a critical link in making sure that people get the fullness of what comes behind. And if you get sloppy, you're going to give the whole generation behind sloppiness. Adam.
It took me a little bit to catch up to what you're saying. So you mentioned the liturgical year, going through the calendar of preaching and the readings. And
yeah.
So then would you say that doing a topical series where you focus only on the Book of Romans for 8 weeks or 16 weeks would not be a way that we should be preaching, because it goes against that?
There's a place for doing like a topical kind of a series thing. I can see that once in a while, and you might want to choose to do that because of something particular thing you want to emphasize, or something you see a need in the congregation, and there can be value in that. There can be value in kind of going seriatim through a book really carefully. But if you notice, most of the pericopes do that, especially with Paul's epistles. You kind of crank through it. You leave things out like 1 Corinthians 5. But So in other words, you can do that, but I don't think there's anything wrong with just being content for a season just to kind of go through with the pericopes and let the pericopes go, because what it does is it kind of forces you to get all kinds of stuff and takes you through all kinds of different parts of it. So, yeah, Annie.
I understand the need to not rely on feelings. Mm-hmm. They're less reliable than other things, but feelings are a huge part of
our embodiment. That's right.
So. How do we faithfully utilize that?
Well, see, this is part of the good habituation, good formation. You use feelings. You're aware of it. You're not indifferent to this. You can manipulate people through feelings, and you can also put way too much emphasis on just cultivating their own feelings. So instead, you're aware of this, and that's why you're not boring. And that's why it's okay to introduce new styles of worship, and it's okay to kind of shake things up once in a while with the liturgy, because it keeps people interested. That's good. And it's okay to sing hymns that people get excited about, you know, whatever that is. For people feel a little rush of emotion, it's cool. It's part of our humanness. There's nothing wrong with that. We shouldn't be afraid of it. Luther was quite emotional about stuff. And there's nothing wrong with emotion. It's just that we've got to keep it in the right place and then be aware of it and use it wisely.
I'd say you're pretty emotional in this class.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I actually talked about that in my paper.
Oh, okay, good.
But yesterday I was talking with Dr. Burrison about the catechumenate, the process of formation that kind of totally ties into today. And he mentioned a church in Valparaiso, how they have the Triduum services, and that's a big part of the catechumenate life.
Oh, yeah.
That people are spending their whole church life, their whole life, being formed, and then so it comes to a head of sorts for the confirmation.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I get it. And you have Holy Week is just this huge event, and everything is all built around this, and the catechism and the baptism all happening with this. Yeah, it becomes beautiful.
And if I may, I'm working with Dr. Burrison, put together a field trip to go see the catechumenates, the Triduum, and so we'll be taking a field trip up there around Easter time to see that.
There you go. So pay attention. All right. Now, we have 2 minutes left for Krauth. Which will not do him justice. Did you guys resonate with what he was doing in here? Did you kind of see how he's putting this whole argument together in a rather tight way, or did you just find this kind of boring? Did you get it? Because if you get it, I don't need to say anymore. It's really self-explanatory. What's that?
This is the one I liked.
You liked it? Well, I'm glad to know that, Kevin. All right.
The rest.
All right. So Krauth is basically making an appeal for, does doctrine matter? Enormously. Are we being arrogant to claim that we've got the right doctrinal truth? No, because if we don't think we have it right, why are we staying here? And he makes the argument so well. If you don't think your church is teaching the right thing, why are you there? It's your responsibility to go start one then if it's wrong. And if it's right, then it's right. And don't be ashamed of that. And there are reasons for why where we are. This is good. I think also outstanding in this short little section from his longer book, and that's why I gave you the table of contents so you can see where this is coming from. Outstanding in here is also he talks about how you have this progression of how false teaching comes in. First, we just need to tolerate it. Well, now it needs to get equal footing, and then before long, it needs to be the supreme thing because it's better than the old one. And he sounds like, well, that's the domino theory, and yet it smacks of reality. This is how these things go, and so it should not be taken lightly. So I commend this to you, and I want you to remember this one and not forget about it. And it's a great thing to fall back on and to think about. When people start challenging you, who says we're the only ones who are right? You know, why does doctrine matter so much? Just get this out, read through these 8 pages, 9 pages, refresh your memory, and then go have at it, because this gives it to you so succinctly and so well. That's why I wanted you to be aware of it. First time I read it, I was just like, whoa, man, awesome. So you guys need to be aware of it. All right, anything else today?
On that topic, I've had trouble dealing with that in the past because should we be humble? Isn't there room for humility? I think we have it right. We could be wrong.
The humility comes in we're human, and we're always recognizing we're talking about God the best we can, and yet God has spoken. And when God has spoken to us through His church, we can be confident. And where the confidence comes in to be able to say is we are consistent with what has been taught everywhere, at all times, in all places, by all people. That's what we can say. And that's why we have our confidence. So in other words, it's the continuity with the regula fide. That's what we're asserting. Not that we've figured it out or we've discovered it. We're simply being faithful to what we've been given. I think that's the attitude you need to present. So I'm not saying I've done all the careful research and I've concluded my way is right. The point is, I've been entrusted with this. This is the right thing because the church has told me this is right. And I'm now passing it on to you because that's what we've been given. So it's that submission to God's reality. All right, guys. We'll see you back next time for a test. Have a nice weekend.